Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
And welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott. I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon. You can reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com or receive our podcasts if you go to Podcast Alley or iTunes. You can check us out, find instructions on our website, and you can have our show delivered to your computer every time you boot up. Isn't that great?
That would be the best.
Hi there, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I speak with greater authority on podcasting now because I finally bought an iPod.
You've actually done it now. But you can podcast right onto your computer, Francis.
Exactly. So. Well, we can podcast onto their computers.
Well, yeah.
And the great thing about this whole podcasting thing is we are having like tens of thousands of downloads. I have no idea why y'all are downloading us all over the world. But
I'm enjoying getting the mail from all over the place.
From France.
That's been really exciting seeing people all over the country.
France and Canada and South Carolina. We love you. We love you, love you all. Today our guest is Charlie Palmer. Charlie Palmer is one of the most famous chefs in the world. He's a noted chef and author. He owns Oriole Restaurant in Manhattan, also in Las Vegas, several other restaurants, many cookbooks. He's a big personality. And his newest venture is the Dry Creek Kitchen in Healdsburg, California, where he's recently moved his family. Total change in lifestyle.
Taking everybody out of New York, moved them out to California.
Yeah, moving from 64th Street in Manhattan to Healdsburg, California is a big life change.
It's a big
there.
Jump.
So we're going to talk with him about that in the next segment of the show, and that's going to be very interesting. So I hope that you stick around to hear us talk with Charlie Palmer. And I think we were talking about the podcasting we've been doing and all the emails we've been getting. You can reach us, Mark at RestaurantGuysRadio.com or Francis at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. And we have been getting some emails, and so we may as well answer the emails. I think that's only fair.
We answer most of our emails via email.
Right, but a couple I think that we've gotten from more than one person we can answer on the air. Or over the computer lines. And the first is, we have been talking a lot about Jersey corn, and we've gotten a bunch of emails from outside the area asking, what is this Jersey corn you're talking about? Mm. Now, what we've told everyone, the things that we've discussed are, there are a lot of sweet corns out there on the market now. Even the local producers are making sweet corns.
Mm, super sweets.
The type of corn that is traditional or was traditional Jersey corn is called Silver Queen, and it wasn't only grown in Jersey, but it had a distinct flavor when you grew it in New Jersey, but that's just maybe your own personal opinion. But the Silver Queen corn was, well, actually, there was an article, we did a little research, and there's a guy named Jim Giammarese, who owns Giammarese Farms right around here, and he was talking about the fact that no one really grows Silver Queen anymore. Because it's not as sweet as these genetically modified corns and these hybrids that are hybrided to be super sweet and not lose their sweetness.
Mm-hmm. So when you taste them side by side, everybody says, oh, this sweet corn really stands out.
Well, it strikes, but it's a sugary kind of a sweetness. Mm-hmm. And here's what our farmer friend Jim says. If you went back to the old Silver Queen
So that would be Farmer Jim?
Farmer Jim, exactly.
Okay, just checking.
Yep. If you went back to the old Silver Queen today, people probably wouldn't like it, said Jim Giammarese of Giammarese Farms in East Brunswick. I'm quoting the New York Star Ledger here. A white corn, Silver Queen, popular in the 70s, Silver Queen tastes milky, corny, and sweet, he explained. But these days, people just like that candy sweet flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are we going and how do we get in this handbasket?
Corn should taste like corn. Should taste just like corn every time, all the time. I want my corn to taste like corn. I want my strawberries to taste like strawberries. Yeah. I want my beets to taste like beets. I want my potatoes to taste like potatoes.
Oh, we got the point, Mark. Sorry. I'm feeling a little...
I want my mean friends to be mean.
That's why you have me around. Here's the deal. Also, Silver Queen had a problem. All corn has a problem. See, when you pick a pear, a pear is one of those things that doesn't need to be tree ripe. It actually ripens from the inside out. So if you wait for the pear to ripen on the tree, by the time it's soft on the outside,
it's probably rotten on the inside.
Asian pears are the only exception to that. But pears are something that they do ripen. You do want to pick them before they're completely ripe and let them ripen off the tree. Let them soften up off the tree a little bit. So that's the one one of very few exceptions. Tomatoes, you want to pick just when they're ripe, and you don't want to refrigerate tomatoes, and you get a couple of days out of tomatoes. Even if you pick it perfectly ripe and you don't refrigerate it, do mm-hmm. not refrigerate tomatoes, do not refrigerate tomatoes.
But they degrade every day.
Right.
I mean...
But not as rapidly as corn. As soon as you pick corn off the stalk, the sugar in corn starts to convert into starch. And starch is flavorless, and it's not sweet, and really takes away from the corn. Now, these super sweets retain their sugar. Not only are they sweeter, but the sugar stays in them longer. So, yes, it's sweet. But when you can find Silver Queen corn, and when you go to your farm stand, say, listen, do you have any Silver Queen? If you plant Silver Queen, I'll buy it from you next year. Because that's what we're doing as restaurateurs.
That's exactly what we're doing.
Next year, we'll have some Silver Queens, because we're going to commit
to it. We get Silver Queen once in a while from the occasional farmer, but it's rare, rare, rare commodity.
Because, literally, the old adage in Jersey is if you pick the Silver Queen, you know, you put the pot of water on the stove, you get it boiling, you walk out into the field, pick the corn, and you know, run back to the water because it literally in 3 hours' time you'll taste the difference in the corn.
You know, it's funny, you don't even know that I did this, Francis, but I did a little experiment with some Silver Queen corn about 8-10 days ago.
Uh-huh.
And the corn was picked fresh that morning.
Mm-hmm.
I cooked a bunch of it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Ate some of it right for lunch that day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I left a couple on the counter, cooked one the next day just to compare it to what I had the day before.
Yeah.
Cooked one the next day again just to compare it to what I had before.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you that the flavor profile in that corn degraded by half probably each day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It was an amazing, amazing difference just in 24 to 48 hours.
Yeah, like day-old corn. I mean, what other produce, you know, goes that way in a day? But when Silver Queen is right, it not only tastes sweet, it tastes like corn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's what we're really looking for. I have another email we want to respond to. I have a Janine from South River, New Jersey. This is a local woman. Hello, Janine. Or Jean. Actually, she signs her name Jeannie. So, hi, Jeannie. I love your show and listen every day. Oh, gosh. I was wondering about something I've never heard discussed before in your show, which is dress code. My husband and I love trying new restaurants, but I'm always wondering what to wear. I don't want to dress formally and look silly, but I also wouldn't want to be the only one in the room dressed in my business casual attire. Do you know a good way to decide what's appropriate?
Probably, Jeannie, the easiest way to do that is just call her head at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the restaurant will give you a good idea of what most people wear. And even if jackets aren't required, say, you know, a fair question to say is, well, what percentage of people do wear jackets when come to your restaurant?
Yeah.
And I find I get a good sense of, well, most men don't wear jackets. Well, half the men wear jackets. That'll give me a really good sense of what I should be wearing when I go out to dinner someplace.
And because you women have so many more clothing options, it's always based on the man. I mean, we're very simple, us guys. Mm-hmm. And so it's either jacket required, jacket and tie required. Business casual, which could mean yes or no. The questions you want to ask are, you know, can I wear jeans?
Right.
Can a gentleman wear shorts? And, you know, if anything says, if you're ever invited to a party and it says formal attire suggested, it's really not a suggestion. Put on the tuxedo. It means if you can't afford a tuxedo, you don't have to come in one. But actually, you can get by if it says formal attire suggested. If you wear a black suit and a black bow tie, you can get away with that.
You know, Francis, one of the things that's changed over the years, there are fewer and fewer restaurants, I think, that require jackets anymore. And I don't know. Every once in a while, I liked going out to a restaurant that was jacket required. And, you know, obviously, that can't be the lion's share of restaurants because most of us don't wear jackets when we go out to dinner anymore.
I like both, but I'll tell you what I do like. I do like when a restaurant does have a strict dress code, because when it has a strict dress code, no one has to feel uncomfortable, and that's the purpose of a dress code. Because if you wear your tuxedo and the guy next to you is wearing a concert T-shirt from the Joan Jett concert in 1985, could be a little uncomfortable.
Right, or vice versa. Actually, frankly, I think it's more uncomfortable to wear a jacket, to be in shorts when the guy next to you is wearing a jacket.
Exactly. I've seen you in shorts and a jacket. Very unattractive. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We'll be talking with Charlie Palmer in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:15. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. And as we promised, our guest today is Charlie Palmer. Charlie's a noted chef and author, owner of Oriole Restaurant in Manhattan and in Las Vegas, several other restaurants. And his newest venture is the Dry Creek Kitchen at the Hotel Healdsburg in California. And he joins us by telephone from California today. Hey, Charlie, how are you doing?
Chef, welcome to the show.
Hey, great. Great to be here.
It was super.
The weather on the East Coast.
That's pretty nice. We can't complain right now.
Isn't the weather on the West Coast always pretty nice?
It's always nice in Healdsburg.
The answer is nice if you're in Healdsburg. Doesn't matter what day, what month, what whatever.
Well, I mean, let's get into the meat of the matter of the current move. Now, you've just opened your newest venture is the Dry Creek Kitchen at the Hotel Healdsburg out in California. Now, you have restaurants all over the country, but your home base was New York for most of the time prior to that, right?
Yes, yeah, until last year. And basically, you know, the Dry Creek Kitchen's been open a couple of years now, but we just moved our family here to Healdsburg. We live right outside of town. And actually, you know, I kind of live bicoastally. I go back and forth to New York. And pretty much my schedule has not changed an awful lot. Mm-hmm. I spend about half my time in New York and D.C., which we have that's actually our newest restaurant, and half my time on the West Coast between California and Vegas. So.
Do you find that makes you a little schizophrenic?
Yeah, I'm a pretty calm guy. So, you know.
What makes a guy uproot his family from the East Coast, New York area, and go out to Manhattan, exactly, and go out to Healdsburg, which is about as different as you could get?
Well, you know, Lisa and I, my wife, had a kind of a 10-year plan, and the idea was that we both had lived in New York for a long, long time, and I love New York. I mean, you know, that's one thing people ask me, like, oh, you moved out of the city. Like, look, I love New York, and I'm there half the time still.
Right.
But we just thought it would be, you know, a good part, a good time in our life to, like, change, you know, where we're at. And we've always loved Sonoma, and particularly Healdsburg, northern Sonoma County. And, you know, we started looking into different things, and we just kept coming back to the same place. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's a pretty neat place. I mean, it's an amazing spot. You know, we have four young kids, so it's a great place for them to grow up as well.
How do they feel about the move?
You know, they love it here. They love it here, but at the same time, they love going back to New York. You know, we were in Christmas time when they were on school vacation. We were in New York in the summer when they just a couple months ago, when they got out of school, we were in New York for a month and a half. So, you know, so they get, you know, best of all worlds, and it's kind of, you know, it's great for the kids. I think the city's great for kids, actually. We live right in Manhattan, and you know, they're exposed to so many great things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, over here in Sonoma, we have, like, you know, we have 35 acres and vineyard.
Right.
And
you have trees, you know, and stuff.
Yeah, they get to run and, you know, avoid the rattlesnakes.
You
hopefully.
Know, it's funny when you say you live bicoastally. I love to – we have a restaurant as well, and we have a wine business as well, so we're often in California. And I like to visit, but I have to say I couldn't live there. I think that living bicoastally would be very traumatic for me because I find myself being too nice to people in New York and too nasty to people out in California.
That's already your problem, Francis.
Wait, I'm in the wrong place. I'm supposed to be nice to you. You know what I mean? Well, now, what is the place in Healdsburg, the Dry Creek Kitchen? What's the mission out there?
Well, you know, the Dry Creek Kitchen, the whole concept of the restaurant is based upon Sonoma County.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we only feature Sonoma grown wines. We have a list that's about 700 selections now.
Wow.
But it has to be grown in Sonoma County. That's the criteria.
Uh-huh.
As far as the menus in the restaurant itself, we concentrate on local food. I mean, and there's very few places in the world that you can do what we do at the Dry Creek Kitchen because within Sonoma County, you know, we have incredible artisanal creameries.
Right.
We
right.
have the coast, which is 20 miles away, so you get Dungeness crab. You know, the salmon is coming in like crazy now. We get ling cod, you know, lots of good seafood. And then, of course, the growers. I mean, we have, you know, incredible produce, incredible tree fruit. You know, it's a really remarkable place in that respect. Is, you know, I can't think of another place in the world where you have it all so specifically in one spot.
Right, and you can literally get produce almost all year round.
Oh yeah, we get stuff, and we literally get guys coming to the back door.
I mean,
we have, you know, with wild mushrooms, for instance. You know, when the mushroom season is just going crazy. They're just at the back door with baskets. You don't just take them. You pick out the ones you want.
That's
you
nice.
Know?
That's
the
nice.
Perfect porcini from Mount Shasta.
Wow. Wow, that's great.
Well, you know, you're a well-known control freak, and we're talking to Charlie Palmer. But, you know, you don't like the cream and dairy that you're getting, so you buy a dairy. You know, you want to have more control over the flowers in your restaurant, so you take over and become partners with the florist. You know, you're definitely got your hands in a lot of things to make sure that the right products are coming to you.
Yeah.
Now, for me, you know, and being a control freak myself, How does that work when you're in one place or the other, and your restaurant is still existing in the place that you're not?
Well, I tell you, I don't think, you know, a number of years ago we couldn't be as successful as we are now, you know, as a restaurant group, because of technology. I mean, technology's gotten so good.
Sure.
That, I mean, for instance, I'll give you a good example. My chef in New York, like Dante Boccuzzi, who's my chef at Oriole New York, mm-hmm. which is obviously very close to my heart, you know, I talk to him at least once a day on the phone. I email, you know, we email each other back and forth, chef-wise. We have a closed website for chefs only, our chefs in our group.
I want to talk more about this in just a moment. Our guest today is Charlie Palmer. He's owner of the Dry Creek Kitchen in the Hotel Hillsburg, as well as one of America's foremost celebrity chefs, and we'll be talking with him more about being a nationally-based chef in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Charlie Palmer, noted chef and author. And we're talking to him about his latest venture in California, but we're also talking about having restaurants all across the country, from New York to Las Vegas to California, and how he maintains his vision throughout all these different places. You can't only be in one place at a time. And tell us more about how you do that, Charlie.
Well, you know, it's definitely a challenge. And, you know, the reason I began opening other restaurants, you know, from the original Oriole in New York, is that I had all these incredibly talented people working with us that eventually they were going to go somewhere. You know, they were going to go on. And I became like, I supplied so many chefs to so many people that finally I got smart, is what I tell people, and said, look, you know, instead of, you know, giving off this incredible talent to other people, you know, I said, I'm going to put them in business myself.
Right.
And the other part of it is, you know, at this point, besides being a chef, I'm a restaurateur, and I love the idea of creating new things.
Yeah.
You know, and like, for instance, our steakhouse in Washington, D.C., you know, it's a very, very different concept than what someone would think of as like a, you know, a He-Man bang on a table steakhouse.
Right.
You know, but it was my vision to create this kind of contemporary, really highly styled, excellent, you know, steak restaurant, but it also, you know, it's very attractive to the female clientele, for instance. We get more, you know, ladies making reservations in our restaurant in Washington, D.C. than men.
Wow.
And I think if you look at I think the national average is like all, you know, 72% of all reservations are made by women.
Interesting.
That's,
you know,
very
interesting. If you think about it, you know,
sure.
Dining options, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who makes the decision? You know, usually the spouse.
Right,
you know, that kind
right,
of thing.
Sure.
It was from the movie My Greek Wedding, I think, where she said, yeah, he's the head of the household, but I'm the neck.
Yeah, well, actually, we're about to open our second restaurant after we've just had 13 years on our first one. And is it easier to run more than one restaurant than it is to just run one?
It's difficult in different ways, I think. I mean, we're at the point now where, you know, as a group, we have a lot of really talented people. So in that respect, it makes it easy when, you know, when we open a new restaurant, for instance, you know, I can kind of take some of that talent from all around our restaurants and bring it into that restaurant, at least for a period of time.
Right.
You know, and you have that strength and that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, we started with a 50-seat restaurant, and we're now four dining rooms and 125 seats, and the hardest thing I ever did was run in that 50-seat restaurant.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Today our guest is Charlie Palmer, celebrity chef, noted author, and pretty cool dude. We'll be back after the news to talk more with Charlie Palmer about his restaurants across America and the state of American dining in general. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or you can podcast us through iTunes or Podcast Alley. Today, we are talking with Charlie Palmer, who was recently named one of the top 100 celebrities in the nation. Now, that's not top 100 chefs. That's top 100 celebrities in the nation.
That's a pretty big deal, Charlie.
Charlie, you're a guy who was famous before anybody was saying bam on the Food Network.
Now, you did a lot of things first. I mean, you opened Oriole in what year? Was it 88?
Yeah, 88. Yeah.
So 88, you opened up Oriole in Manhattan, and now you have Oriole in Las Vegas, and you've done a lot of really, I mean, before there was a Food Network, Charlie Palmer was a celebrity chef. And your food has a lot of integrity. It's not just, you know, like in the old school of celebrity chefs, maybe the food wasn't on the plate as much as it was the image of the person. And I've dined at both Orioles a number of times, and the food's great, and the service is great, and it's true to its original intent. Now, you were the first guy to go out to Vegas that I know, so maybe you weren't the first, but you were among the first to go out in Vegas and blaze new trails out there. What's it like having a restaurant in Vegas?
Well, you know, I think Vegas is fantastic, and I think, you know, there was the what I think a very, very bad misconception of from a lot of people that when, you know, when someone went out to Vegas, it was, you know, just they were copping out or they were, you know, doing something stupid. And I can't tell you how many different, you know, opinions I got when I decided I was going to do this. But from my standpoint, I thought, here's an opportunity to be really on the forefront of food in a major city.
And it's really gone through a culinary renaissance.
I mean. I mean, at that time, there was no food. I mean, Wolfgang was open, you know, Spago was open, Emerald was there. But besides those two, there was really not much going on.
Well, and even with those two, I mean, when you opened Oriole there, I think you brought fine dining up to, like, an incredible level. I mean, it was a leap up at the time.
Yeah, I mean, but I saw it as an opportunity. And, you know, people say, like, Vegas. What's Vegas? Vegas is our clientele there is not much different than New York.
Right. I
mean, these are travelers from all major cities, you know, nationally and internationally. You know, and they're people that are looking for great food. They're not looking for something different because they're in Vegas. They're people that are looking for great restaurant experience. You know, and when people are in Vegas, they're entertaining. They're being entertained. You know, and there's that excitement of the whole thing.
You know? Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting, Charlie, is I was out. You invited me out very kindly. Thank you for the opening of Oriole in Las Vegas so many years ago. And I don't really like to gamble in casinos. And usually when I'm in a casino, it's on business, on restaurant business or wine business.
Right.
And I was out in Vegas, and I've been out to Vegas since. And I went out as a diner, and I had a great time. I didn't even I gambled $20.
Absolutely,
And I know more and more people now who, if they're anywhere near that, who are diners, will go to Vegas to dine.
Sure, it's become a dining destination.
And may also gamble. It's not just to service the gamblers.
Right. I think a good example is, you know, you have the Four Seasons. It's a non-gaming hotel. That's where I always stay.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a big gaming guy. I'll be the first to say that. I don't understand it. To me, it's like, you know, you're throwing your money in this machine, or you're giving your money away. If you got that much money, give it to a charity. You know, don't give it to the casino. But
to me, opening restaurants, that's gambling enough for me. That's all I need. That's all I can take.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And for me, that's what I tell people. Just make sure that you dine first before you gamble.
Right,
I don't want you to run out of money.
Exactly.
Cancel your reservations. Sorry, my credit card's maxed, Mr. Palmer.
Now, we've seen in Las Vegas an incredible change, but hasn't there been an incredible change in restaurants in the nation, both from a diner's perspective and from a professionalization of the people who work in restaurants?
I mean, I would think you would have a great perspective on this, being in all these different cities
for this
period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people, you know, and people always pose this question to me, but I don't think there's ever been a better time to dine in this country because, you know, whether it's New York, which is an incredible restaurant city, or it's Las Vegas, which is coming up, or it's San Francisco, which, you know, really has some incredibly great restaurants. There's just that bar has been raised over and over and over. And I'm not talking about just the high, you know, the highest end restaurants. I'm talking about restaurants in general.
Sure.
You know, and cooking in this country and going all the way back to, you know, the suppliers has just gotten better and better.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, think about it. 10 years ago, you couldn't get the kind of produce or
the kind of
poultry or the kind of things that we work with now.
No, it's
you couldn't
true.
Get them. You couldn't find them anywhere.
Well, it's fun, and it's given us an opportunity to be even more demanding and more discerning in the kinds of things that we choose in our restaurants.
Oh, absolutely.
But what's very interesting is, you know, and I know that you have on the East Coast and the West Coast, our restaurants are all here in New Brunswick, New Jersey, but we have forged over the last 10 years relationships with farmers to the point where, and talk about an exciting time to be in a restaurant. I mean, it didn't even occur to me 10 years ago that I'd be in a position where I have four or five farmers that I deal with, as well as the agricultural extension of Cook College, which is the agricultural school at Rutgers University, where we meet in January to talk about what seeds are going to be planted for me to harvest. You know, I was like, oh, we'll try this kind of tomato this year. And it's more challenging to buy locally when you're in a temperate climate like in Jersey. But, you know, we contracted for a lot of tomato plants, and the tomatoes are coming in right now. We're putting them all up for the winter.
Sure.
But that kind of stuff just, I mean, no restaurateur did that I know of 15 years ago.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, the only hope that I have is like the diner understands that, you know, because I think sometimes, you know, a lot is taken for granted. But if the diner, you know, really was, you know, educated as to how far we go to get things that are really good for them, you know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, it's just really great.
I'm not a huge fan of the Food Channel, but I do think that's really helped to educate people and let people know what lengths we go and are willing to go to get the best product on the table.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, the Food Channel in general has been great for food in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, take something like Emeril, for instance. I mean, he's a good friend of mine, but this man has done more for food, I think, in this country than anybody else. Because he's reached, you know, all levels.
That's exactly right.
I deal on a certain level. I deal, you know, mostly with, you know, higher income people. I mean, let's face it, you know, I'm not going to pretend it's not the case. But Emeril, he's got people that would normally be at a fast food restaurant thinking about cooking at home, thinking about eating something, you know, interesting and good for you.
You know, it's funny. I have an 11-year-old nephew who is, I mean, he's a foodie. I know he's just a foodie. And he watches the Food Channel, and he watches Emeril, and he wants to make that stuff because he sees this on TV, and I think that's really great. You know what is an interesting paradigm, though, Charlie, is as we, you know, get involved with sustainable agriculture, keeping family farmers on the farm and buying the kind of food that we buy, and we're willing to go to the ends of the earth to get the best produce, and it's often found very locally, but it's always more expensive. And we're a high-end restaurant. We're maybe probably one of the most expensive restaurants in Jersey. But that gives me the freedom to be able to buy, you know, this kind of, because these farmers that are on these small farms cannot operate as cheaply as the big agribusiness farms.
No, absolutely.
So,
but at the same time, supporting those farms makes it more likely that consumers are going to be able to get that.
But there's my question: what do you think of the paradigm between to support the local family farm? You've got to, like, it's rich people that need to, or people who have a lot of disposable income to spend on food, who need to pay more to be able to keep these farmers on the farm. Isn't that an odd dichotomy?
Well, I think it's odd, but I think, you know, I talk about this all the time because I'm in a community where there's a lot of really small growers here in Sonoma and in Healdsburg, you know, and then of course you go to the green market, you know, heirloom tomatoes are $2.50 a pound.
Right.
You know, and that kind of thing. And you could certainly buy tomatoes for half that price.
Of course.
In lots of places, but they're not as good. They're not as tasty and they're not, you know, you're not helping, you know, sustain these farmers. And I try to tell people all the time, it's like in a restaurant. I mean, how little can you charge? You know, is it expensive? Well, yeah, maybe it's more expensive than you think, but, you know, this is something that's really good. So people have to make a choice, and I think they have to understand it. I think, you know, the thing we need to do better as chefs and restaurateurs and stuff, and hopefully journalists too, is make people understand why they're paying what they're paying.
Yeah.
You know?
One of the things that Francis and I talk about frequently and that we've gotten away from in this country is we shop once a week. Some people shop once every other week. And you just can't get the best products if you're going out once a week to the store to buy produce.
Your ultra homogenized milk is not going to be as good if it's ultra homogenized. You know, that's not a good thing. It says ultra, but it's not necessarily a good thing. Our guest today is Charlie Palmer. Charlie Palmer is one of the most important American chefs, restaurateurs, authors, and he's been kind enough to talk with us today about the state of dining in America. And we'll talk more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Francis and Mark, Central Jersey. Jersey 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Charlie Palmer. Charlie Palmer owns Oriole Restaurant in Manhattan and Las Vegas. His latest venture is the Dry Creek Kitchen at the Hotel Healdsburg out in California. He's also an author and one of the top 100 celebrities in the country. Charlie, we were talking before about restaurants all over the country, and you had invited me out to Oriole when you opened it in Mandalay Bay, and you put in there a wine tower, which was sort of a very interesting, it's a cellar that is above ground, and would you tell us about your wine tower? Because it's kind of kooky.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the wine tower, the idea was we had an incredible selection or incredible collection of wines, I should say, with our partners, which was one of the hotel owners. And I wanted to come up with a unique and interesting way to display the wine in the restaurant, to make it accessible to people. What we came up with is what we call, what has been dubbed the wine tower. And what it is, it's 43 feet high. It's 18 feet square. Glass and steel enclosure, which is all refrigerated in zones. So it's all temperature controlled in six different zones.
You have to tell us about the wine fairies.
Yeah, and then in the middle is the core is like these Lucite wine bins that holds about 10,000 bottles.
Yikes.
And the way you access the tower is we have what we have described as wine angels. And the wine angels have some kind of acrobatic background, but they hook up to these pulleys, and they have these little thin cables, and they wear acrobatic harnesses, and they go up and down in the tower, and they have a very simple system. It's just they have an earphone, earpiece, and the sommeliers on the floor have a microphone in their ties. And what happens is, like, you know, when someone chooses a wine, say it's a wine 2207, she automatically knows it's side two, bin 207. She goes, flies up in the tower, pulls the wine out of the bin, and brings it down and gives it to the...
So she flies up on these on this rope system.
On these cables,
on this cable system. They fly up there.
Peter Pan-esque.
And they, you know what? I've never seen an ugly wine angel in your tower.
Black Calvin Klein.
Oh, my God. You know, it's funny because I'm always tempted to ask a sommelier for which bottle is way up high because that's the one I want to order.
Those are the $10,000 bottles.
I don't even know. They aren't that hot. I will tell you, though, the ugliest wine angel ever to fly in Charlie Palmer's tower was... One night, you let me go up there, I don't know if you recall.
Yeah, somehow you and I don't have that kind of, like, form.
I was actually a little scared, to be honest with you. But, it's a very beautiful and interesting thing. Now, wine is pretty important
Charlie, if ever you're looking for a wine linebacker, I'm your guy, all right?
You're there.
Now, wine is... Overall, aside from the tower and the way it's presented, wine's very important to you and your cuisine, and you're very active in, I mean, obviously, this is a centerpiece of a very important part of what you do.
Yeah, no, I consider wine a huge part of our business, first of all, in the 11 restaurants. But, you know, what we try to do is create interesting and great wine programs for each restaurant, and each one is different. You know, like Dry Creek Kitchen, you know, my goal is to create the most exclusive, collection of Sonoma County wines in existence, and I think we're probably at that point, but we still have lots of places to go.
But how important? But wine, do you think wine is incredibly important to the appreciation of food? Because I do.
I do. I think food and wine are so intertwined at this point that it's almost like you have to have it. You need to have it.
Well, I think it's part of the experience, and of course. It would be like going out to a restaurant and not having dessert. I think not having wine. It's all there. It is all intertwined and part of the same.
Well, I think as a chef, you can create an incredible dish, but if you can create an incredible dish and find the perfect wine pairing for it, it just puts it at that another level.
One and one equals three. Another one of our mantras.
And I think that's one of the things that comes with having a great wine staff. And you have always, my friend Stephen Geddes, who invited me out to your opening, he was a master sommelier, and you've always had great wine people in your organization, and hopefully we have great wine people in our organization. But we always tell people, what our mission is, listen, you may not, even if you're not a master sommelier and you don't know the most about wine in the world, you should know more about the wines in the cellar of the restaurant you're working in because you're tasting them on a nightly basis. And you should know more about the food that your chef is preparing so that you can put that thing together in a way that someone who's not as familiar with either can't do. And I think that's the mission of a restaurant. It's part of the dish. It's not just that the food is finished and then there's the great wine. It's that, like you said, they go together, and only a staff that works with them on a daily basis can see that.
I mean, we've taken it to another level as far as, we did what I call a joint venture with a number of wineries. I mean, we're so entwined and so entrenched in wine here in Sonoma that, Daryl Groom from Geyser Peak, the winemaker, is our neighbor.
Just like picking, the peaches from your neighbor, the wine is part of the agriculture in the region you're in.
Absolutely. I mean, I grow Pinot. It's right outside my door here.
Awesome.
So, that kind of thing. But, you know, like Rocchioli's my neighbor, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, what we did is I took a collection of our sommeliers, you know, Keith Goldston, Stephen wasn't around at that point, but from all the restaurants, and we came, you know, we brought them up to Sonoma, and we went to these wineries, and we blended from eight different barrels or, you know, different lots. We blended a Chardonnay for us only.
And what's it called? What do you name
it? Called ISC, International Sommelier Conspiracy.
And always with a sense of humor. Hey, Charlie, we want to thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Charlie, thanks so much for joining the restaurant guys today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're going to link your site to ours, and you can find out about Charlie. And pretty much wherever you are in the country, you're never too far from a Charlie Palmer restaurant.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Take care, Charlie.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. You're back with the Restaurant Guys. That was a great little show we did today with Charlie Palmer as our guest.
Well, it's not over yet, Francis.
Well, the Charlie Palmer part is over. He's gone back to do whatever he's doing out in California. He's just a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Restaurants all over the country, they all still have his imprimatur. Oriole in Manhattan, still great, beautiful restaurant after many years.
I think it's what's really impressive is his restaurants don't have a corporate feel.
Not at all.
Even though he is clearly a corporation.
Well, he talked a lot about keeping good people.
Mm-hmm.
And when we asked him, why did you decide to expand and become a restaurateur with multiple restaurants, he said, I had great people in my organization,
mm-hmm.
and eventually they were going to leave. And you know what?
You know, it was funny. When he said that, the first thing I thought of was...
That's sus.
Was, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons we're opening a second restaurant is there were eight people in my organization who could run a restaurant, who were capable of running a restaurant.
And if we didn't provide them with opportunities, they were going to go elsewhere. And
absolutely.
So we needed to be their best option. And, you know, it's funny. You have a loyalty in the restaurant business when you work with talented people.
Mm-hmm.
They're loyal to you, and they do great work for you, and you need to be great for them. And you need to keep the opportunities there for them to grow as people and make the job a good part of their lives. And actually, we're opening soon a restaurant called Catherine Lombardi in New Brunswick. It'll be our second venture. And so if anyone's out there looking who is a restaurant professional, we know because we get your emails that a lot of you are listening to this program. I'm looking for wine professionals and mm-hmm. some places in the kitchen as well, because we're about to open up a pretty significant Italian restaurant. And
all we need to do is open about 12 more restaurants, a florist, a dairy, and a hotel, and we'll be right there with Charlie.
One step at a time, man. One step at a time. Yeah, also you got to remember the thing about Charlie Palmer is he's on TV and we're on radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know why?
Because he's better looking than we are.
Because he looks like he does and we look like we do. Yeah, but I eat a lot of good food. Took a lot of good food to get me looking like this. That's all right. I don't mind. But I was a wine angel in Charlie Palmer's show.
That must have been a fun ride.
Super duper.
Better than Six Flags.
And there's wine at the end of it.
Better than Lightning Loops.
So if you want to reach us, you can reach us at restaurantguysradio.com, which will link you to stageleft.com, which is our restaurant. And there you can apply if you want to come and work with us or you want to come and find out about the restaurant and have dinner with us. And we hope that you do on our way with our second restaurant to be just like Charlie Palmer. He's our hero. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.